Somebody asked me about the, let me think if I can remember, who asked me, where is that person, about the gap theory. The gap theory says that between verse 1 and verse 2 you have millions of years, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit, where it came from historically. But what modern gap theorists in the 20th century believe is that Satan fell, and when he fell, God cast him to the earth, and that brought a flood. They call it the Luciferian flood. And so the whole geological record of rock layers with fossils was produced by Lucifer's flood between verse 1 and verse 2. And verse 2 is describing what the world looked like after that destructive flood. And then the 6 days of creation are 6 literal days of recreation. Now, there's huge problems with that. One is that, let me see if that's cooled off enough. We'll try this. Yes. Just one thing. Huge problems with that, and that is that, that's not in focus, is it? Got bumped a little. Is that in focus? There's theological problems. One is the Bible nowhere says when Satan fell. All we know for sure is that he fell before he deceived Eve. Secondly, the Bible says nothing about any kind of flood associated with the fall of Satan. It doesn't say God judged the world when Satan fell. It just says he was cast down to the earth. And third, you have the problem that such a gap theory does nothing to win approval from the scientific establishment, because they don't believe in a Luciferian global flood any more than a Noachian global flood. So you've accomplished nothing, and there are huge problems with the Hebrew and just exegesis of those first two verses. The gap theory came in simply to try to make quick peace with the millions of years. It's really not a sound position, and I'm going to explain that here as we go. Let me see if this will work. I want to draw your attention to two verses before we look at the historically where the millions of years came from. And one is 2 Corinthians 10, verses 4 and 5. Paul says, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." So Paul says we're involved in a war. It's not a war of bullets and missiles and chariots and arrows, and it's a war of ideas. It's a war of imaginations raised up against the knowledge of God, and raised up against the Word of God, which expresses the knowledge of God that we need to know. And so Paul says, be careful. We're involved in a war, and it's a fatal war, much more serious than the wars that we face in our world today. And then in Colossians 2, Paul says, "Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ." So Paul gave a warning to the Christians in Colossae, be careful about philosophy and the traditions of men. Now, Paul did not give warnings in vain. He gave them because he knew it was a very real possibility that Christians could be deceived. In fact, many Christians were deceived in his day. And all the way through church history, Christians have been deceived by philosophies of men. And as we go through where the 19th century and where this millions of years idea came from, we're going to see that that is precisely what has happened again. The church has been deceived by philosophy and vain deceit. Now, the idea of millions of years was not the product of one man and one book. It developed over several decades and took hold through the writings of several people. And I want to introduce you to 8 of those most influential people. And if you're not into history, don't panic. I review, and there's no exam. So you don't have to worry about remembering the names and the faces and the people. But I got pictures, so that helps too. Comte de Buffon was a naturalist with wide scientific knowledge, and he was a Frenchman. And in 1778, he published his book, Epics of Nature, in which he imagined that the Earth was once a hot, molten metal ball, and it slowly cooled and condensed to become the planet that we live on. And he did experiments in his laboratory with different metal balls, heated them up to see how long it would take for them to cool. And on the basis of this and his imagination, he calculated, or at least published in his book, that the Earth was at least 78,000 years old. His private journals and unpublished manuscript indicate that he really believed the Earth was at least 3 million years old, but he didn't have the courage to publish that date, and even 78,000 was not acceptable to the Roman Catholic authorities at the time. Then there was Pierre Laplace, an astronomer. He published in 1796 Exposition of the System of the Universe, in which he imagined that the solar system had once been a huge spinning gas cloud, as you see in the top of the picture. And slowly, over long ages of cooling and condensing according to the laws of physics and chemistry, it slowly produced rings like Saturn, and then those rings coalesced to become the planets of our solar system. Then there was Jean Lamarck. He was a naturalist specializing in shell creatures, and he wrote Philosophy of Zoology in 1809, in which he published his theory of biological evolution over long ages. This was a forerunner to Darwin's theory that came 50 years later. Most scientists at this time rejected any kind of idea of biological evolution, but this was the seed of one of the seeds of Darwin's theory. Then, in terms of geology itself, there was Abraham Werner, who was a German mineralogy professor, and he wrote a book, Short Classification and Description of the Various Rocks, which was primarily, as the title indicates, descriptive, but he did put in there his theory of the Earth, which was that the sedimentary rock layers that we see most graphically in the Grand Canyon, but which are everywhere on the Earth, he believed these sedimentary rock layers were produced by a slowly receding global ocean over about a million years' time. He was partially right. It was produced by a global ocean, but he had the time scale all wrong. Now, his theory was very simplistic, and it didn't hold in people's minds, but the idea of millions of years did stick with his students, many of whom went on to be the Europe's greatest geologists of the 19th century. Then there was James Hutton, working at the same time up in Scotland. He studied medicine in the university, took over the family farm after he graduated, but his real love was geology. And in 1788, he published an article, and then in 1795, a book by the same title, Theory of the Earth, in which he imagined that the Earth was being eroded into the seas. As he looked at his farmland and studied the surface of the Earth, he said, look, at the wind and the rain is eroding the topsoil and just eroding rocks, just a grain of sand or particle of rock at a time. It goes into the rivers. The rivers carry it to the ocean where it's dumped. And he imagined that over the course of long ages, those sediments would become hardened by the internal heat of the Earth, and then some convulsion would raise them to become a new landmass, which would be eroded into the ocean, which would eventually be lifted up and erode into the ocean. And so he saw Earth history as cyclical, and he made the comment he could see no evidence of a beginning in the rock record, a statement which brought the charge of atheism by many of his contemporaries. Now, Hutton didn't pay much attention to the fossils in the rock, but Cuvier did. He was a French comparative anatomist and paleontologist, studied fossils. And in 1812, he published his theory of the Earth, which was based on several journal articles before that, in which he believed, as he studied the fossils and the rock layers in around Paris, that the Earth had suffered many regional or nearly global catastrophic floods over the course of long ages, and that those many floods were responsible for producing the geological record of rock layers and fossils. Now, he believed that the last flood was about 5,000 years ago, which coincided with Noah's flood. But he believed that most of the geological record was formed long before man by these earlier floods. And then William Smith, who was a drainage engineer and surveyor, and in the course of his work of helping to build canals and railroad passes and tunnels and bridges and roads, he saw the rocks and the fossils and became fascinated. And he developed the method of using using fossils to give relative dates to the rocks. So if he found a rock layer over in Wales that had a certain type of fossil, and he found a rock layer over in England that had the same fossil, even if they were not physically connected, he'd say, well, those are the same age because they have the same fossil. And if he found a rock layer that had a different fossil on top of the one over here, and he found a rock layer somewhere else that had the same fossil, even if it wasn't on top of the same rock layer over here, he'd say, well, those are the same age, and that one is younger than this one over here because of the ordering. And so he became known as the father of English stratigraphy because of developing this method, which is still used by evolutionist geologists today. And then finally, Charles Lyell, who was trained as a lawyer, but his true love was geology. And in 1830, he published his first of three volumes of Principles of Geology, in which he rejected any notion of regional or global catastrophic floods and said that everything in the rock record could be explained by slow, gradual processes, just as we see today, occurring throughout Earth history. So no regional or global floods. So let's summarize here, and then we'll represent it. These ideas with the timeline. Buffon believed in a cooling Earth over about 78,000 years, but his private belief was it was much, much longer than that. Laplace imagined a nebular hypothesis for the origin of the solar system over long ages. Lamarck developed a theory of biological evolution over long ages. Werner believed the rock layers were produced by a receding ocean over about a million years. Hutton, his view became known as uniformitarianism because he saw the processes going on today happening throughout Earth history at a uniform rate, and he saw no evidence of a beginning in the rock record. Cuvier became known as a catastrophist because he believed in these multiple catastrophes over long ages. Smith was also a catastrophist, developed the method of using fossils to date the rocks, and then Lyell was the champion of uniformitarian geology over long ages. So we can represent these views with two major views of Earth history. One was the catastrophist view. Smith and Cuvier were two leading spokesmen. They believed in God. Their writings indicate they believed in a God, but they weren't Christians, and we don't know exactly what their theology was, but they believed in a supernatural beginning, SB, and they believed that God created the first forms of life, and life went along for a while, and then there was a catastrophic flood of regional or nearly global proportions that wiped out most or all of the creatures living at that time, and then God created new creatures, or the few that survived migrated in and filled in the rest of the earth, and life went along for a long period of time, and there was another catastrophic flood that destroyed most or all of the creatures, and then the earth recovered from that, maybe with some supernatural creation activity by God, and life went along again for long ages, and then there was another catastrophic flood. And this happened many times throughout history over the course of millions of years up to the present time. That view reigned in geology for about 30 years, but it was replaced in the 1830s by the uniformitarian view. Lyell and Hutton were, from their writings, were not sure whether they believed in a beginning to the earth or not. So put a question mark there about supernatural beginning. But then they believed that there had never been any regional or global catastrophic floods on the earth, but that every geological process of change, erosion, sedimentation, volcanic activity, earthquake activity, has always happened throughout Earth history at the same rate and frequency and power as we see going on today. Nothing unusual. Everything uniforms, hence the name uniformitarian geology. Now, those two views were opposed by a number of Christian writers who became known as the scriptural geologists in the early 19th century. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about them later. But they believed the biblical traditional view, that is, a supernatural creation week of 6 literal days of creation, just as Genesis described about 6,000 years ago. That was followed about 1,600 years later by Noah's flood, which the scriptural geologists believed was responsible for producing most of the geological record of rock layers and fossils. And then the earth recovered from that and continued up to the present time. And all of that period was about 6,000 years based on the biblical information. But the scriptural geologists were not, that was not the only response to these old earth views. Other Christians responded in a different way, trying to fit the millions of years into the Bible. And so Thomas Chalmers was one. He was a Presbyterian minister and a naturalist. And at the age of 24, as a young pastor in 1804, he began to preach the gap theory to his congregation, which I just explained at the beginning. He became a leading evangelical, very articulate, persuasive preacher. And so lots of people favored that view. But there were other Christians who said, I don't see any evidence of a gap there. George Stanley Faber was one of those men, a respected conservative Anglican theologian. And in the 1820s, he produced a book in which he argued for the day-age view, that the days of creation are not literal days, they're figurative days of long periods of time for each day. Now, most Christians, if they knew anything about what the geologists were saying at this time in history, they didn't favor the day-age view because they could see that there was a difference in the order of events that the geologists were saying in terms of when creatures appeared in the geological record and the order of events according to Genesis. The order is different, as I alluded to in my first lecture. So the day-age view wasn't so popular. The gap theory was more popular until Hugh Miller. Hugh Miller was a friend of Thomas Chalmers. He was a Scottish Presbyterian layman, and he was a geologist. And initially, he favored the gap theory. He was a good friend of Thomas Chalmers. But just before his death, he switched over to the day-age view. And because of the respect that he had in the Christian community, and because he was a geologist, many Christians began to favor the day-age view. So from about 1850 onwards, the day-age and the gap theory were competing together. Not only did Christians have to reinterpret Genesis 1, they also had to reinterpret the flood account. And John Fleming was a Presbyterian minister and a zoologist in the 1820s. He began to advocate the tranquil flood view, which says that Noah's flood was global, but it was so peaceful it left no geological evidence. And the proof of this is right there in the biblical text. Noah sent out a dove and she came back with an olive leaf in its beak. And that just shows that the flood was so peaceful it didn't damage any of the plants. That just revealed how ignorant he was about olive plants. They're one of the hardiest plants on the planet. They've done experiments where they've taken branches off a olive tree, stuck it in salt water for several months, plop it in some wet soil, sprouts, and starts growing again. A tranquil flood is actually an oxymoron. As they would say in the Deep South, there ain't no such thing as tranquil floods. John Pye Smith had another idea. He was a congregational theologian, and in the 1830s, he advocated the local creation and local flood view. That Genesis 1 was describing a creation in the Mesopotamian Valley, modern-day Iraq, and the flood was likewise just in that localized area, and it's just described in the Bible in exaggerated language. Well, those were all conservative Christian responses to the millions of years idea. There was one other response that was developing, and that was the view of liberal theologians. Now, liberal theology had been developing on the European continent for since the middle of the 18th century, but it had been held at bay in Britain and North America because of the influence of the Great Evangelical Awakening under the Wesleys and the Whitfield in England, and Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards and others here in the United States. But liberal theology was beginning to penetrate the church here as well, in England in the 1830s, and the liberals said, you other folks are all wrong. Genesis 1 to 11 is mythology. Just like the ancient Babylonians and Assyrians and Egyptians had their creation myth and their flood myth, so did the ancient pre-scientific primitive Jews. But we live now in the scientifically enlightened era. So let's summarize then. You have the compromise positions with old earth geology. In the 1810s, Chalmers starts advancing the gap theory. The 1820s, the day-age view and the tranquil flood view. The 1830s, the local flood and Genesis is myth. And in the midst of all of this, you have the scriptural geologists contending that not only are the geological theories, many of them saying not only are they contrary to Scripture, but they're also contrary to the geological evidence. And I want to tell you about one of those scriptural geologists. But before I do, I want to read to you what Charles Lyell said about these men. He was the champion of uniformitarian geology, and he described them as, quote, wholly destitute of geological knowledge and unacquainted with the elements of any one branch of natural history which bears on the science. They are incapable of appreciating the force of objections or of discerning the weight of inductions from numerous physical facts. Instead, they endeavor to point out the accordance of the Mosaic history, that's Genesis 1 to 11, with phenomena which they have never studied, and every page of their writings proves their consummate incompetence. Put in very simple English, Lyle was saying, these scriptural geologists are Bible-thumping scientific ignoramuses. They don't know anything about science. They don't know anything about geology. They ought to just keep their mouth shut. Totally incompetent. They can't even think logically. Well, whenever a student of history reads a statement like that by one person about his contemporaries, the wise student will say, I wonder if that's a totally accurate description. And as I began to read the writings of the scriptural geologists for myself, I found that nothing could have been farther from the truth. And I want to introduce you to just one of the men that proves Lyle wrong. George Young. He was born into a poor Scottish Presbyterian farming family in Scotland. He was born without a left hand. So that ruled out farming for him. And he came to faith in Christ at a young age, and his parents encouraged him to go into the ministry, which was consistent with his own growing convictions. But before he went to study theology, he went to the University of Edinburgh and studied science and math, graduating near the top of his class. He then went and studied for 5 years under a leading theologian, and then became the pastor of a little church in Whitby on the east coast of England, where he pastored until his death. He was greatly respected by Christians of all denominations for his concern for the poor, as well as his burden for evangelism and missions. But he was also an incredible scholar. He knew many languages, Hebrew, Greek, Latin, French, and Italian. He was also acquainted with Arabic, Chaldean, Syriac, and was considered an authority on the Anglo-Saxon language. And when I read that, I became totally depressed. How could he get all of that learned and be a pastor? But beyond that, he was also a very competent geologist. And he wrote 3 books on geology. Geological Survey of the Yorkshire Coast, published in 1822, revised and expanded in 1828. This book was praised by the leading geologists of his day for the accurate descriptions he gave of the geological formations in Yorkshire, where most of the geological record was exposed in the sea cliffs and in the mines and caves. But the leading geologists of his day totally ignored the last part of his book, where he gave his theoretical interpretations of what he had so accurately described. And he was describing, he was interpreting everything in light of Noah's flood. And it's kind of similar to what we have today. Most people don't read the writings of the creation scientists. They just say, well, those people couldn't possibly know what they're talking about. They never refute the arguments. They just ignore them. Well, George wrote 2 other books. 1838, he wrote Scriptural Geology, which is one of 2 books. by that title in this time period, and that's where these class of writers got their label, scriptural geologists. And that was the most thorough defense of the biblical account of creation and the flood in light of geology that was written. And then he wrote Appendix to Scriptural Geology in 1840 to refute the arguments of John Pye Smith for a local creation and local flood. But George Young was not the only scriptural geologist who I demonstrated in my thesis was geologically very competent by the standards of his day. There were many other men who, both by reading of geological literature and by actually going out and studying the rocks and the fossils out there in the field, in the real world, who were writing against these old earth theories. And they were raising biblical, geological, and philosophical arguments against these old earth theories and against the various compromise views, the day-age, the local flood, etc. But their works, just like George Young's, were not refuted. They were just ignored. And so we have to ask then, what was the real nature of the debate? Throughout the last 200 years, historians of science have always said, well, it was that they actually call it the Genesis geology debate. It was a debate between people who were scientifically ignorant, fundamentalists, and the scientists. No, it wasn't. George Young was not ignorant. And the other men that I studied, many of them were not geologically ignorant or scientifically ignorant. The real nature of the debate was philosophical and religious. Now, we are not going to get too detailed here, but we need to understand what was going on at this time. There was a view that was beginning to flourish. It was called deism. How many of you have heard of deism? Okay, quite a few of you. Just a brief summary and how it relates to our topic here. The deists believe in a God. They believe He's the Creator. But they believe that He made the world in a simpler form. He made it kind of like a watch, wound it up, set in motion the laws of nature, and then He let the universe run according to those laws which He established. And so it is developed and changed according to the laws of nature. So in the deist view, God is distant back there in the past. He created the world. He set it up and He left it to run. He doesn't interfere. He doesn't do anything to the universe now. And so the deists rejected miracles because a miracle, in their view, is God violating the laws of nature, violating the very laws that He made. And so there was no incarnation, there was no resurrection, there was no inspired scripture in the deist view, there was no virgin birth, because those would be violations of the laws of nature. And God couldn't violate His own laws. Now, deism received a firm response in the first half of the 18th century, so that by about the middle of the 1700s, there were no openly deistic writers in Britain. But their ideas did not disappear. They went underground and had a big influence on the development of liberal theology on the European continent. And they came back into vogue in the early 19th century in Britain through science. Then there was the atheist view. Now, in the atheist view, obviously, there is no God. The universe is all that there is. Now, there have always been some atheists, but they were pretty far and few between throughout human history because most people think it's pretty ridiculous to think that this world made itself or has been here forever. Most people are religious in some sense. But in the atheist view, there is no God, so then everything must be explained simply by what we see in the physical world. Now, contrast those two worldviews with the Christian worldview. Like deism, Christianity, the Bible teaches that God is distinct from His creation. We in theology, we say God is transcendent. He is up, above, beyond, outside of creation. If the creation would disappear, God would still exist. He was there before He made the world. And so He's distinct from His creation. But there's another thing that the Bible teaches related to our topic, and that is that God is immanent. That is, He is present everywhere in His creation, upholding His creation by the word of His power. And He works in His creation, and from time to time He does miracles. Now, in the biblical view, a miracle is not a violation of the laws of nature, because the laws of nature are not like traffic laws. They're not prescriptive of how God must act. They are descriptive of how He usually acts to sustain His creation. And miracles are simply God working in an unusual way. So normally, I go to work at 5 minutes after 8, Monday through Friday. What's happened? That's not my computer, is it? Okay, great. Thank you. These things have a mind of their own sometimes, don't they? So I go to work at five minutes after 8, and I come home about 5:30, quarter to 6. That's what I normally do. But see, I'm not acting normally right now, because yesterday I was not in the office. If somebody was watching me outside my house spying on me, they would see, Terry didn't go to work yesterday. I didn't violate any kind of law. I was just doing something unusual, traveling to Wisconsin. Well, miracles are God doing something unusual, but God is at work, whether He is providentially sustaining His creation or whether He is working in a supernatural, unusual way. Now, so in the 19th century, you had this battle of these ideas, and a German scholar writing about this early 19th century period said this: "We cannot overestimate the influence exercised by deistic thought by the principles of the humanist worldview on the historical critical exegesis, that is, liberal theology, of the 19th century. The consequences extend right down to the present. At that time, a series of almost unshakable presuppositions or assumptions were decisively shifted in a different direction." In other words, the Christian worldview had dominated Europe for about 1,500 years. And science was born in the Christian worldview. It was the assumptions that come from the Bible's teaching that laid the foundation for creation, or for science. Why can scientists study the world and expect it to be orderly, so that if they do an experiment today, throwing a ball up in the air 100 times, if they do the same experiment tomorrow, or they do it on the other side of the planet, the experiment will work the same? Why? Because God is the Creator, and He created an orderly universe. It's not just working in some arbitrary, confusing, contradictory manner. Why can a scientist think that if he studies the world, he can understand rationally what's going on? How can he even trust his rational thoughts? Comes out of the creationist worldview that God made man in the image of God. And therefore, since God is a rational being, men can think rationally about the world. So let's look at those older theories. Buffon was, we know quite a bit about these men, either from their published writings or their private journals. And historians of science have dug this out for us. Buffon was a deist or a vague theist. Laplace was an open atheist. Lamarck was a deist or an atheist. Werner was a deist or an atheist. Hutton was a deist or an atheist. Cuvier was a deist or some kind of vague theist. Smith the same. And Lyell was a deist or a Unitarian. These men were hardly unbiased, objective pursuers of truth. They were living in a Christian culture. They were consciously unchristian. And some of them explained their views very explicitly. Here's just one quote I could give by James Hutton. He said, "The past history of our globe must be explained by what can be seen to be happening now. No powers are to be employed that are not natural to the globe. No action to be admitted except those of which we know the principle." Now notice, the key words here are now and natural. When he said that, and he said, this is how our past history of our globe must be explained, what was he ruling out? Noah's flood. Is Noah's flood happening right now? No. Was Noah's flood natural? No. It was supernatural. in terms of God starting it, there was lots of natural things happening. Water did run downhill as it always does. It did erode as it moves fast, just like it always does. But there were supernatural things going on. The flood did not happen just as a fluke in nature. So he is saying that that's the way we've got to reason. Well, he's just ruled out supernatural creation and a global flood before he ever looked at the rocks. And that was in his article in 1788. Hardly anything was known of the rocks of the earth at that time. And he certainly hadn't studied very much of the rocks. In his book, 7 years later, he said, "But surely general deluges, that is global floods, form no part of the theory of the earth, for the purpose of this earth is evidently to maintain vegetable and animal life and not to destroy them." Well, yes, if you look at the present world is designed to sustain plant and animal life, right? But you see, his problem is he's figuring out the past by just looking at the present. What's he ruled out? He's ruled out Noah's flood on the basis of wrong reasoning. The flood was not designed to preserve animal and plant life. But God told us that in the Bible. It was designed to destroy things. So what we're really dealing with here in the 19th century is what we call today philosophical naturalism, or just naturalism. It's also known as scientific materialism or atheism or secular humanism, all the same philosophy. And there are two basic assumptions in this philosophy. One is that nature or matter is all that exists. That's an atheist view. Now, there are scientists who are theists who believe in God, but they play the game according to the atheist rules. They act as if nature is all there is. They think as if nature is all there is when they're in their scientific mode. Now, when they go to church on Sunday, they don't think that nature is all there is. But when they're doing their science work, that's the way they behave. And that's the atheist rule of the game. The second principle or assumption is that everything can and must be explained by three things: time and chance and the laws of nature working on matter. If you have those three things, time and chance and the laws of nature, you can explain everything you see in the rocks, in outer space, in living things. Those are the assumptions that control the scientific establishment in the world today. You see the debates going on in the press that's talked about all the time. 20-some states trying to get intelligent design in the public schools. And the scientific community is resisting this. You know why? Right there. That's why. They're saying we can't allow God in the picture anywhere. They have even defined science now. Even though science was born in the womb of Christianity, they've defined science in an atheistic way. So that you can't really believe in God and be a scientist. Well, you can. You actually be a better scientist. So the battle here is not at the level of the facts. The scriptural geologists, the catastrophists, and the uniformitarians, they all had the same rock layers and fossils that they were looking at. The battle is at the level of worldviews. It's at the level of assumptions. Philosophical naturalism against the Bible. And we're going to look at that a little bit more in the next session. But let me just mention a few of the resources before we take our break. First of all, free resource, our Answers in Genesis website. We have over 5,000 articles on the website. We add a new article every day of the week, at least one new article. Most of these are understandable to lay people, and they're fully documented for the serious scientists. So they're a great resource for students to do research papers. You can find answers to your questions. And in fact, don't write to our office a question until you've checked our website, because we probably already have an answer on the website. There's just a wealth of information there. You can sign up for our free newsletter on the sign-up pads on the tables. Comes 12 times a year, and it has a short article explaining why this issue is important. Lets you know about other resources and other seminars that are happening in your area. The best resource that we recommend for people to grow in their knowledge of creation and evolution is the Creation Magazine. It comes 4 times a year. It's a beautiful, full-color, glossy magazine for the whole family. Again, all the articles are fully documented for the serious reader, but they're written at a level that 11-year-old and up can understand, and powerful arguments. And you should have gotten a sign-up form when you came in today. You can sign up. And if you sign up this weekend, You can get one, two, or three free DVDs, depending on whether you subscribe for 1, 2, or 3 years. And those DVDs are on the table over here with the sign DVD special. Any of those DVDs you can get. And you can also buy those special DVDs on that table at special price if you buy in quantity. So a great way to learn. These are all some of our most powerful lectures. People often ask us, what one book should I get? And we say, well, these three. If you're new to the creation issue, this is what I would recommend. The Answers book deals with the lie, explains why this issue is so important and why the church can't compromise. And the Answers book answers the 20 most asked questions. There's a whole chapter on the gap theory, a whole chapter on the day-age view, global flood, where the races came from, what about dinosaurs, what about radiometric dating, that kind of thing. And then the other book in there is Refuting Evolution, which every high school and college student ought to read. And their parents ought to read it before they give it to them as a gift. So I highly recommend that. So those three books in that pack. Then there's a more economical pack that has those three books plus four others. And they're all listed. And then all those books plus some DVDs are in the super special pack. And then the library pack, which is an instant creation library for a family or church. And there's also a number of booklets over there that answer a number of different questions, great witnessing tools. If you want to study what I'm talking about in these two sessions in more depth, I've only got about 35 or 40 minutes with each of these sessions, but this is a two-hour version of what I'm talking about today, and then a one-hour version of that is this one. And if you spend a lot of time in the car and you want to listen to some audio lectures, you can get that one. So we'll talk about where we go from this early 19th century on into the 20th in our next session. God bless.